This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick on Twitter at OldFLA and visit his website, rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hey, Rick, how you doing?
I'm ready to pod.
Are you really? I'm ready to pod too. How are you feeling about this cold weather?
It's like we have a real winter this year. The mornings have been in the 40s for like 2 weeks. It's strange. It's like, wait, is this Florida? Although, you know, there are instances where the sky is crystal clear and it's, you know, that's why we moved to Florida, or people moved to Florida years ago. But the mornings have been chilly for as long as I can remember in the recent days.
40s
and 30s. We had a number of days at 39. So that's,
oh, I'm
that's
so sorry.
30. Yeah. You know, it's just what it is. I mean, honestly, we have very little to complain about compared to the rest of the country. It's just different than what we've had the last few winters.
It doesn't mean you're okay with it.
I was sick, so I stayed in a lot, and then I had a lot of things going on. I still have, first quarter is always a super busy time for me, so it hasn't hurt what I want to do. I have wanted to get out on the water, and I, when I was sick, I was like, you know, the last thing I need to do is go get wet and be cold. So it's kept me off the water, but that's the only thing that's really affected my day.
Now, when you say the water, you're usually talking about freshwater springs and rivers.
Yeah,
right?
It's always freshwater for me. You know, I live inland, so that's what I mean is, I had planned to do a kayak trip along the St. John's River near Enterprise, and you know, because I got sick, I just didn't do it. And that's a big sheet of water, so you get quite a breeze, and that's the last thing I needed with this cold I had.
Yeah, I used to work on boats. I had a part-time job, and I got to tell you, when you have a cold and you have to be working on a boat, it is no fun.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's still miserable. Better than working in a factory, I guess, but privilege. It's all privilege, I guess.
And, you know, I was thinking about, I don't think I made up this term, my home waters. And I do see kind of the St. John's River as my home waters, because that's, you know, it's part of my past. When I was a kid, we had a place on the St. John's River when I was in fourth grade. And, you know, that's the big sheet of water that I live closest to, so that I can get to Sanford in about a half hour. So that's what I consider my home waters. And
I can't believe anybody in Orlando is more than 10 minutes from fresh water.
Well, I mean, I'm literally 30 steps from
right, you're
here.
On the water.
I'm on the water, yeah. I've kind of let the wood ducks take over my backyard, so I try not to disturb them because they
you're
go
scared
shrieking.
Of them, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. They're terrifying with their big bills and their razor claw talons.
When ducks attack tonight on a very special blossom.
Now they go screeching away, and it's like, no, just let them have the lake this time of year. They won't. They're snowbirds. They'll be gone in a couple of months.
I mean, that's nice. You let them have the lake because they were, you know, actually there first, but you'll let them have it.
Yeah, I've noticed, you know, this is apocryphal, that the number of migrating birds is a lot less than it used to be. We used to have big flocks of cormorants come, and they would just take over the lake and, you know, fill it up. And it was wonderful because there were people who would actually not let them have the lake, and they would like set off fireworks to get them to fly. But the flocks were so big, they couldn't just like take off straight. They would kind of have to do a corkscrew and, you know, gain altitude as they went up and up and up and up, because they were just these huge numbers of birds. And I don't see that anymore. You know, if I do see cormorants, there's usually less than six. So I don't know what to attribute that to. Maybe they've changed. It's one of those things. If you're to stay in the same place long enough, you notice what are perceived to be trends, and that, you know, there's a lot less of these migrating birds than I used to see.
Well, maybe they think this winter is too cold too. I don't know. Don't tell me that. Don't tell me there's less birds. Less birds is bad.
What I do notice though is more white pelicans. It used to be you didn't see white pelicans at all here, but now
those,
I see
those
big
bastards, man. Those... They're Those birds are, they're scary.
Really? You think they're scary? Not as scary as wood ducks.
I mean, okay, wood ducks are small but mighty. I give you that. But I, yeah. Hey, I wanted to just ask you. I think I've asked you before. I don't know if I have asked you on the podcast. Have you ever heard of some place that would have been somewhere between the Apalachicola River and the Atlantic Ocean in Florida called Big Spring?
No. Okay. I will say this. Springs are frequently renamed. And, you know, a couple examples. The one in Safety Harbor was called Green Springs, and they thought it was too close to Green Cove Springs, so they changed the name. Rainbow Springs was called Blue Springs. There's at least a half dozen Blue Springs that are, you know, in the state today. And another one was Kissingen. It was usually called, originally called Pont Spring, which would have made, and, you know, we have De Leon Springs and a Ponce de Leon Springs. So, you know, name changes or rebranding of springs is a common occurrence. So it could be one that we call something else today, but I've never heard of that.
All right. Well, here's why I'm asking, because it's in my book, mm-hmm. which, you know, I should know more about things that are in my book, but it was mentioned in the Talking of the Keys. So go back to the 1800s, mm-hmm. Right before Spain just pushed Florida back to the United States and was like, look, you're too much trouble. We had a Spanish governor, Don Juan de Estrada, and he gave Key West to a Spanish officer named Juan Pablo Salas. And it was just listed as for services rendered without pay. Like, here, have a rock in the middle of the ocean.
Gee, thanks.
Oh, great. What am I going to do? Well, he didn't do anything with it until a year after Florida was legally part of the United States. So you can imagine that this makes all kinds of problems. So he actually, Salas sold Key West to a man named John Simonton, which is why there's a Simonton Street in Key West. But the guy was a New Jersey native working out of Alabama. He bought it for $2,000. The problem was Salas had also made another sale to a man named John Strong, who had already sold the island to John Geddes. I mean, this is just a very convoluted thing. So Geddes finds out about it. He sends a group to Key West on a schooner named Revenge, to give you any idea about how he felt about this. Ultimately, this whole big mess goes into this lawsuit, this 1820s lawsuit. And the settlement was Salas, instead of Key West, he gave Geddes a boat and some acreage at a place called Big Spring in East Florida. And that's all I could find about it. Big Spring in East Florida. And I thought, well, maybe it's dried up. Maybe it has, like you said, another name.
Yeah. But,
I mean, are we just not good at tracking the names of springs? You listed some, you know, because if you Google Big Spring, it just gives you Big Springs, not right. Like Big Spring. There is no Big Spring State Park. So it sounds like you know of several times where we've actually kept track of the name changes.
Yeah.
But no, that doesn't ring a bell. For it wasn't like a big healing waters.
It's easier to keep track of the ones that were developed commercially, you know, so a lot of the ones that, you know, are state parks or county parks or on private property, you know, it's harder to know what they're called. And there are several springs that have multiple names, you know, that according to the locals, there's one on the Santa Fe that some people call Mermaid Springs and other people call it Jonathan Springs, just because it's on, again, it's on private property and there's no like state park there with a sign out front. It is common, you know, again, Safety Harbor was at one point called Bailey's by the Sea, you know,
like the liqueur,
the what?
Bailey's liqueur.
Well, there was
Bailey's Irish Cream.
Yeah. Like that. But that was before it was called Green Springs. And so there, you know, it's constant in what's in a name, you know, as we record this show, there's talk of changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico. By the way, we're political on this podcast, and I just want to clarify that for one of our listeners.
Yes, we got a there is a way through the Buzzsprout platform, which is who hosts our podcast, there's a way to send fan mail. And somebody who did not give their name from it looks like St. Louis, Missouri, sent us not a question, but a comment that we had made the comment, charge more for the blue states, and said that they thought this should have been edited out because they didn't realize the podcast was political. And I just want to be clear. I don't remember what we said, charge more for the blue states. I'm pretty sure, as both of us being fairly liberally minded, that was a joke. But yeah, we do get political on this podcast, and the Springs are actually pretty political themselves. If you want to talk about bottled water and total nutrient loads, things like that, I promise you it gets very political very quickly. And if you don't believe me, I would encourage you to go back to the episode where we had Ryan Smart from the Florida Springs Council on the podcast, because that was wildly, wildly political, which is okay. Sometimes it's okay to get passionately political.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I think it's the perfect topic for the podcast. One, it's one of the things in Florida that is the most spectacular, our thousand springs. And two, I think it's an area where, you know, we're at a critical time in the health of the springs, and we can still make a difference. You know, we can still reverse the course. There is a guy who's a hydrogeologist named Todd Kincaid, who says we're past the point of no return, that they're kind of ephemeral systems, that, you know, they'll be really healthy when we have huge rain events, but most of the times they're not ever going to be what they used to be. But that's an opinion, and I don't know if that's true or not, but we can make a difference by raising awareness.
Yeah, I that nihilism talk I find very disturbing, because I go back to Clam Bayou and Boca Ciega Bay, which Boca Ciega Bay is the body of water between the Barrier Islands and the mainland in southern Pinellas County. So if you're thinking St. Pete Beach, St. Treasure Island, all those places, Fort DeSoto, that get millions of visitors a year. And Boca Ciega Bay is the area that is where I live. I mean, I can get there in less than a mile. I walk down there all the time. And in grad school for my Florida Studies degree, I did an Environmental History of North America seminar, and my semester-long research project was an environmental history of Boca Ciega Bay. And, you know, it's got Clam Bayou in it, which is a tidal estuary, you know, it gets flushed out. And in there is a collection of essays called Paradise Lost. It has a question mark at the end. And it's all about Florida. And in one of those essays, Bruce Stevenson wrote about Boca Ciega Bay, and he made the point that in the 1950s, state biologists said Boca Ciega Bay is dead. It will never support life again. And that is patently not true. Is it the cleanest body of water in Florida? Absolutely not. Is it the worst? Absolutely not. There's been a lot of efforts. There's been a grassroots effort. There has been a state effort. Sometimes those two things were at odds, but it got wildly political for a few years. I mean, screaming matches at city council, nasty letters. People felt passionately about it. And you know, the tide turns, no pun intended. So when people say, well, springs will have these good periods and they're just done, I find that to be very destructive, not only for our outlook on the world around us, because, I mean, you hear that enough and you just want to grab a bottle of cheap whiskey and rock in a dark corner, and that's not healthy. But also, we'll stop trying. You know, you keep putting this negative talk out there, people will just stop. They'll be like, well, what does it matter? Let me throw my old radiator from my car into the spring, right?
It's a tough thing because, you know, we're hurting our springs in two ways with, you know, the amount of pollutants we're putting on agriculture and on our lawns. You know, that contributes to algae growth. And, the you know, there's too much water being withdrawn from the aquifer. So those two things need to be corrected. You know, that's why I'm such a big native plant advocate, because you don't need to fertilize the hell out of them and you don't need to water the hell out of them. And that's, you know, one of the biggest things. If we can advance that consciousness and change people's thoughts about what a perfect lawn needs to be, that'll be helpful. But it is hard to remain optimistic. I do think, you know, it's so weird. I was watching one of the things that we can have on television in our house that's just background is HGTV, because my wife and I don't always agree with what should be on because she likes the TV on. But the other day, they, you know, it was this guy, David something or other, and he was showing homes in Spring Hill, Florida, which is by Wikiwachi. And, you know, it was beautiful. They had these B-roll shots of, it was probably the Wikiwachi River, but they just looked lime green to me. And that's not what they should look like. You know, that is impaired water. And I'm aware of that because I grew up in Florida in the 60s and 70s. And you know, and I, and there are still pristine springs that do look blue. But so many of them just don't look right to me. And especially when you're bragging about them, and they're just like, you know, they're not supposed to look like lime Kool-Aid. They're supposed to look like those weird blue drinks you get at the 7-Eleven with ices.
Okay, like the blue thing?
Yeah, the blue thing.
They're supposed to
be blue, not green. That's what I'm trying to get at. So, anyways, right. But I wanted to talk about some of the ephemeral springs, the ones that no longer exist, because there are a number that have dried up. Kissingen is probably the best known. It was the spring in the heyday of Polk County, where they had all the social gatherings, like political rallies and picnics, and you know, people would go there on Sundays. And then you can find great photographs of it. Well, you know, there was a building there that, you know, people had dances at, and it, you know, it was kind of the social activity hub for the area around Bartow. And so phosphate mining is one of the big industries there, and they diverted the water from the spring, and it's pretty much dried up. You can find historical markers in, I think it's called Mosaic Peace Park. And it's ironic that the company Mosaic that is involved in phosphate mining that diverted the course of the water has naming rights on this park now.
Really? Does it shock you?
No, it's not. It's so Florida.
I mean, we named Edward Ball Wakulla Spring State Park after Edward Ball, after he strip mined all the pine trees.
We should do a show about Ed Ball at some point. There's so many contradictions and ironies in Florida and Ed Ball. And, you know, it's so funny when you watch something on PBS and it's sponsored by Jesse DuPont Ball, who
it's
was
like,
his
really?
Widow.
Like, does anybody know? No.
So, yeah, there's all his connections to Florida. I mean, he was probably the most powerful man in the state in the 1950s and 60s. And he owned Wakulla Springs, and it's, you know, it's flowing, but it's not what it was. It's majorly impaired. Again, it's green. And there, when I went there the first time, I remember they had these little brochures out, and the brochure was about what happened to the Limpkins, because I guess one of the things that people remember from going there historically was that Limpkins, because they make these loud shrieking cries, you know, I hear them on our lake all the time, but they had disappeared because the water quality had decreased to the point that the things they eat, which are freshwater mussels and snails, didn't exist anymore. So the limpkins have moved on. And I don't know if they still have those around or not, but that to me was an indication of how bad things had gotten there. And, you know, Wakulla is, in terms of the amount of flow, one of the biggest springs anywhere. Have you been to Wakulla?
Oh, God. Yeah, I've been to Wakulla. The first time I saw a snake on a body of fresh water was at Wakulla. I'm lousy at spotting snakes. I'm not good at it. I'm sure I've been very close to them. But yeah, I've been to Wakulla multiple times. The first time I was at Wakulla, the Tallahassee Film Commission, Tallahassee Film Council, they used to do a creature fest every November. And they'd show Creature from the Black Lagoon in the park at night. And I was up there for that. And then, you know, I've been back. Barry and I have been back. I went back as part of my coursework. It was one of the requirements for the degree. You know, it's just a beautiful spring. I can't imagine losing it. I don't know how else to say that.
Yeah, I was shocked the first time I went. You know, I went on the boat cruise, and they said, you know, and there was a glass bottom boat, and they said they can only run the glass bottom boat 3 or 4 days a year at that point. So
really,
keep in mind, this was 15 years ago or so, because the water's just not clear enough for them to see. Like, you know, at Silver Springs, the water quality is good enough. You always see the bottom. you know, no matter where you are. And it's still one of my favorite things to do in Florida, despite, you know, the water quality issues they have there. There's, you know, recently I rented a clear canoe, but it's nothing like the glass bottom boat. It's just so much fun. And, you know, you see everything. It's just, you know, my thrill of the glass bottom boat ride is one of the rare things that hasn't changed, you know, in all my years of life. You know,
you mean what you see or your delight at it?
My delight at it. And, you know, it's the things that have changed were, you know, they used to have this thing they called catfish football, where they would feed the I guess are they channel cat? I think they're channel catfish. And they would just congregate in this big mass fighting for food. And you don't see channel catfish in there at all anymore. You see these invasive plecos, I call them. They're these armored
plecostomus.
Yeah, I call them plecos. Bastards. You see a lot of those, and you see a lot of tilapia, you know, because of that stupid dam, the native fish species have been greatly reduced. So mostly what you see are invasive. So that's the big change. But, you know, in terms of just the thrill of it, it's so exciting. And to be able to see that far down, that clear, and, you know, you go over a part where there's, you know, there's a, it's like an old boat sitting on the bottom, and then there's props from movies still down there. I love it.
How can you not love it?
I don't know. If you love Florida, I think you love the glass bottom boat ride.
It's such a quintessential Florida experience. I'm sure they do them other places. But I want to go back to something. I know we're supposed to be talking about springs that are gone. Mm-hmm. But you talked about the catfish. They used to have Henry the pole vaulting fish at Wakulla,
yeah,
where they would get him to jump over a pole. So
he,
I wonder
he would kind of swim over it, you know.
Yeah, I think pole vaulting is a little.
Yeah, he wouldn't jump out of the water.
But I mean, I did. What other state has like these fish acrobatic sideshows? I don't know what else to say.
There was another one that was a mascot. It was Happy the Walking Fish for this defunct, short-lived attraction in Daytona called the Atomic Tunnel. And he was one of those, you know, walking catfish I think they probably got from Brazil or South America or something. And they turned him into the mascot, so they had this kind of cartoon version of him, just like Henry. Those things continually inspire me to make art.
I mean... So, I'm stuck on Atomic Tunnel Daytona. you have a post about it on your website.
Yeah, yeah. My friend.
And it has a little fish. It has a little fish.
Yeah, that's Happy the Walking Fish. Happy, I think. Yeah, right.
No, you didn't draw that, did you?
No. But I did make a ceramic one that, and it sold at the art show that I had up in Sanford. So I may make another one. I've been wanting to make a Henry. But I haven't quite figured out how to do it because the pole itself, I will need to find another material. It's but I think I'm going to make a Henry as well. Springs continue to be a source of inspiration for me, and I keep thinking about ways I can kind of immortalize them in artwork. So I had this idea of making shrines for each spring, and then the centerpiece of the shrine would be a water bottle, like a clear bottle, that I would fill with water from each of the springs and then observe what happens to them over time. You know, are they so, will it stay clear or will it get green and gross and gunky? That's part of the experiment. I just haven't pulled that off.
Do we want to know the answer?
I think that's part of it. You know, it's like duct taping a banana to the wall. You know, what happens to it? So, and I should look up on the science. Do I
need like
to
cork
the
Florida
it?
Version of Banksy is what you're saying.
No, but it's an idea. I haven't yet done it, but you know, like Margaret Tolbert's a great example of somebody who's an artist who's inspired by our springs because they are so spectacular. And she continues to create art. You know, she will, she's done things like she brings slate underwater in our springs and draws on the slate while she's in the spring. And she does painting, plein air paintings. And they're very kind of impressionistic and abstract almost, but you can see the reference to the spring. So they're not You know, she's not painstakingly rendering cypress knees. You know, it's her impression of the spring. I think we need to have Margaret on. I've been meaning to get her on as a guest.
Margaret, if you're listening, get on here.
But there are other artists as well who are, you know, the spectacular nature of the springs motivate them to make art. And that's
it is a
why
breathtaking
we talk about
place.
It. It is.
I mean, it really is. Every spring. But I mean, we talk about these ones that disappear. How does that happen?
Most of the time, you know, another good example is White Sulphur Springs in the little town of White Springs off the Suwannee. And again, phosphate mining in the area diverted the path of much of the water that was, you know, feeding the spring. It comes back when there's a, you know, big rainfalls that somehow that conduit underneath the ground gets renourished. And I'm told when it does come back, you can smell sulfur. But I've never seen it that way. I've seen it either one, dried up completely, so there's just a little puddle down at the bottom that doesn't flow, or two, when there's so much rainwater in the Suwannee that it's browned out, you know, so it just looks like, you know, this big brown puddle in the middle, because the spring house is still there. That's the thing that, you know, I have the inspiration for my book actually was, you know,
isn't
the spring
that on
house
the cover?
At White Sulphur. Yeah, no,
that's that's one with people.
Yeah, but there are great photographs of just, you know, all these people, and I don't think they're all invalids, you know, just four stories high on the inside, just, you know, hundreds of people at this spring. And, you know, honestly, White Springs is so in the middle of nowhere, and it's still a great place to visit. It's where the Stephen Foster State Park is and where they have the folk festival every year. I recommend a trip there if you're up in the area, just to walk around and experience the town. It's the town that the spring built. You know, the whole reason the town exists is because of that spring that is for the most part dried up now.
Yeah, and the Suwannee River, God bless our water management districts. The Suwannee River Water Management District really undersells that. While fire destroyed most of the neighboring hotels, and the spring is no longer the tourist attraction it was. Like, can we maybe get a little more, can we explain why? But I guess not. No, we cannot explain why. So that's one. So I had always heard of one called Hampton Springs, but I actually don't know if that's still around.
It's still around. It's a county park in Taylor County. The interesting story, sorry, I still have vestiges of the cough. It was developed. And it was mostly people in Chicago who frequented it. You know, it was reliant on the railroad. So there was a little spur that would come over from Perry, Florida, to get to the hotel. There, a lot of sportsmen came, but they had a famous brand of bottled water that they sold in pharmacies throughout the Southeast. The hotel burned down and it was kind of lost, but somebody had a vision to kind of cobble together a bunch of different state grants and grants from other places. And they did archaeological excavations and rediscovered where the pool was with the spring and created a county park there. And so the spring kind of bubbles up from, it looks like this little hole in the ground, and then used to go over this little wall and fill this little pool. And then from there, it would trickle into this creek. But and people would love to swim there. But so, you know, you basically have a pool that's unsupervised. The county was worried that somebody was going to break their back or crack their skull and they would get sued. So the county had this wonderful idea of filling it with concrete so nobody could swim there anymore. This was maybe 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I can't keep up with time. But there was such an outcry from all the citizens, they came back and removed all the concrete and let it flow again. It's an odd kind of park because it's off the beaten path. And, you know, there's been talk of having somebody live there year round and they wanted to kind of make it into an RV park. So there'd always be a constant presence there. I haven't been, so I'm not sure if they've resolved that. But the spring, you know, once again flows. You can see as kind of the water trickles down the wall, the high concentration of minerals still in the water because it's, you know, there's kind of this calcium deposit that's left behind. But it was a very popular spot until it burned down. They used it for the hotel for training during World War II. Very interesting site if you're up in that neck of the woods.
And is there a reliable website we can put? Because I'm not finding one that I mean, there's obviously no state park.
I'll finding, see if I can find you a link.
Because some of these, there's one website here that talks about ghost towns, and I've been on this website and they have said things are ghost towns that are not. So I just want to make sure we're giving our listeners some accurate information.
It's got an Atlas Obscura page.
Well, there we go. That's even better than a Rick Kilby page.
I may have blogged about it at some point. You know, to me, what I like about places like that is, you know, there's this ancient tradition of water being used as healings going back, you know, to the early days of civilization, ancient Greeks, ancient Romans. And, you know, they used to have places like Bath, England, and all these great spas of Europe. To me, places like this in Florida are a connection to that and show this unbroken human history of people that revered water and believed water had healthful uses. And that's why I think it's important to keep these places intact. There's other ones that I worry about that I haven't visited in a long time near there in Panacea Springs, which is in the Big Bend area, where they had a number of little springs just kind of popping out of the ground. And some of them had little structures around. And there's been hurricanes that have come through there since I've last visited. And I have no idea what kind of shape they're in. I know one of the structures is gone. It was like a little pavilion. I think there was as many as a dozen springs there at one point. And then the other one that I've seen recently, our buddy Ryan went there. It was fenced
off.
He's
all over the place.
I can't believe him. We talked about this last week. Ryan went up there and it was fenced off when I went up there, and it's Newport Springs. And it's not fenced off anymore. So I think you can, it's probably on private property, I'm sure, but you can get right up to the spring. You can always get up to springs from the water if you're kayaking. You know, there are places where they block off the water, including block off the springs from the water, like Wakulla Springs. Ed Ball did that. He put a fence up. And I think the fence is still there. I can't figure out why. And there's some on private lands where they blocked it off, but you can always enter through the water because it's something about the law of being able to navigate waterways. So, but there, you know, there's a group, it's fun to visit, and especially the ones that have, you know, vestiges of this human history. Another one is Suwannee Springs, which is just across the river. And I think a little bit further north from White Sulphur Springs, where they still have kind of the bones of the old spring house.
But the spring is still there?
The spring is still there. It doesn't flow. You know, it's hard to know how many of these springs, how big these springs originally were, because a lot of times they would build these spring houses, which in some case would raise the level of the water. And now that there's less water flowing, you know, we may never know what they were like 100 years ago. There's one Worthington Springs that is no longer flows. I think it's in Union County. And the story is, and you never know if these stories are true or not, the guy had a couple kids and the kids were playing and there was a little trickle of water coming out from a tree. So they did what kids naturally do, is they'll dig it up, you know, let's make a pool out of it. And before they know it, they had dug up a little pool. And then at some point somebody said, hey, we can turn this into a place where people can come and bathe. So let's make it a formal pool. And it all started with a little trickle of water coming out by the base of a tree. And so it was very popular in the late 19th century. It's where people, you know, there was a train that went up there from Gainesville and a train that came from Lake City and Jacksonville, and they would have big 4th of July parties and things like that. So now I believe it's a county park, but the spring is long gone. You know, there's nothing there to indicate that a spring ever even existed at some point. And it's so hard to know, you know, once they dug it out, was it, you know, what we classify springs in terms of magnitudes. Was it a first magnitude, second magnitude, or a third magnitude, or something even smaller? And just because they built a little pool around it and the water accumulated, you know, would we even classify it? But now it's gone. So,
yeah, that's there's a little bit of history about it on the Town of Worthington Springs website. And it's just the way we describe these things, you know, nobody, bureaucrats don't want the blame, right? So it's all very dancing around it. In the mid-20th century, the outflow from the spring declined and then stopped flowing completely. I mean, what does that mean? What happened? Tell people what happened. Let's talk about that real quick. What kills a spring?
Usually it's diverting the course of the water, you know, and it's hard with Worthington to know because, you know, it prospered at a time before there were water management districts who measured the flow of the water. So it's hard to know how much of a spring existed there. But usually what happens is industry or agriculture or something that uses a lot of water diminishes the amount of water. And, you know, if you think about the aquifer under the ground, you know, it's not like we're on top of this giant bubble. You know, we're on Swiss cheese and there's little pockets of water that are connected in those little holes in the Swiss cheese by small conduits and stuff. And if, you know, one source of water gets low enough so that water no longer flows through the conduit, you know, the spring will dry up. You know, it's like this perfect thing that happens where the ground is low enough and there's enough water pressure to reach that surface where the ground is low enough to make a spring. It's like this beautiful combination of things that happens, you know, and if one of those is taken away, the spring is gone.
Well, I mean, you can over pump too.
Over pumping is the major thing. It's so funny because though one of the things that can make spring go away is actually putting too much water on top of it. And so there have been instances like De Leon Springs in Volusia County where they wanted a bigger spring pool. And so they raised the level of the little, I guess it's a dike or a dam, to make a bigger spring pool. But the weight of the water actually forced the water down from the spring and it popped up in the spring run. So they ruined what they had. So what they had to do was get a big steam shovel and, you know, tear down all that stuff they had built and then fill that hole that had popped up with concrete and cement and all this kind of stuff. So it would start flowing from its original source. So we can mess them up. There's another one I talk about in my book that's in the panhandle that they tried to enlarge with dynamite and they caved it in.
Why did we think that was a good idea?
I don't know. Because, you know, it's like the big spring thing. You know, you see a second or a third magnitude spring and it's like, what's preventing this from being Silver Spring? So it's like, well, the cave's not big enough. What if we made a bigger cave? So they get in there.
Seem like we should be messing with that.
Yes, I agree. Don't mess with Mother Nature. Mother Nature knows best. Do not destroy the spectacular part of Florida by trying to make it better.
Please do not dynamite the Florida Springs. It doesn't seem like something we should have to say. And yet here we are. Yeah. I mean, overpumping is the one you hear about around here a lot. You know, that's the big danger as you get anything close to the aquifer or close to salt water, because once you pump a spring, once you pump a well so much that you, once you pump a spring so much that you overpump it. I don't know what the word is. I had it. It was gone. Once you pump a spring so much that you overpump it and get all the fresh water out, if it's by salt water, what you're going to do is you're going to start to get salt water infiltration. It'll suck up the salt water. And salt water, of course, is denser than fresh water. So that well, or if you're doing it from a spring, that's it. It's done. Like there, you don't unring that bell.
Yeah, and in a lot of cases, there's layers. So the fresh water is on top of the salt water, you know, especially around the coast. And so as you pump out the fresh water, the salt water starts to rise. And so you'll get salt water intrusion in your freshwater wells. And, you know, that's the thing that I don't know if people realize, you know, the source of the water from the spring and a source of the water from the well right next to it is likely the same source. And so it depends on the level, you know, how deep the well is. But if you're pumping water, you know, for instance, at Silver Springs, they pump water. People, I don't know if a lot of people know that they pump water out from wells right near Silver Springs. You know, a lot of the ones that have been well known on the Santa Fe and the Suwannee, where people have fought against bottled water permits. Those are right next to springs, you know, and they're wells, and they take water from the same aquifer that comes out of the spring. So as that water decreases, the amount of flow coming out of the spring diminishes.
Yeah, and it's definitely one of those things you can change the topography forever.
Yes, or the hydrogeology, I think. Well, forever is
both.
So, you know, the thing
okay,
is.
Okay, not forever, but you can, you'll change, when I say that, not just the hydrology, when I'm talking about the topography, you'll change what can grow around there is my point.
The thing is, you know, hundreds of years from now, let's hope it's hundreds of years from now or thousands of years from now, when people aren't overrunning the planet, these systems could come back. But part of the problem is that, you know, the way the aquifer in Florida works is, you know, you'd get water raining on the ground. It would percolate through the soil, through the lime rock, and fill these big underground caverns full of water. But so now what happens is we've paved over most of the state. Greg Pittman has a book called Paving Over Paradise. You know, think about every time they build a strip mall, they build these huge, huge parking lots around the strip mall, and then they have little retention ponds. So all the water that used to fall on that parcel of land percolate through the ground and end up in the aquifer now hits this parking lot and goes into a retention pond. And that water does not perk into the ground. It gets evaporated. And so we're not feeding the aquifer. So one of the big fights that we have in the state is trying to protect the land that's undeveloped, so that the green swamp is one of the places that is critically important, so that enough water will fall there, percolate it into the earth, and recharge the aquifer. So the other thing that has to happen for springs to be restored is eventually it'd be great if we didn't have parking lots everywhere and retention ponds, because they are not recharging the aquifer. And that's a huge, huge thing that development takes away as the, you know, the state continues to grow and we, you know, pave over paradise. That's a great title that Craig came up with.
Yeah, it's accurate too.
Yeah.
I had written a short blurb years ago, not that many years ago, 2016, there was a exhibit. Benjamin Dimmitt, who was a local guy, had an exhibit called An Unflinching Look, Chassahowitzka Saltwater Intrusion. And it was photographs he had taken along the Chassahowitzka and talked about how there was salt to show what happened with saltwater intrusion. And I remember we got some, I can't remember if it was Tampa Bay Water or another state affiliated agency. Somebody sent me a letter at the paper like, hey, you know, that isn't even part of the Florida aquifer. And how dare you make it sound like something bad is happening? And, you know, the answer is simple. It's like, well, all water's connected in mm-hmm. Florida, you know, that sort of thing. But he had
all water's connected everywhere.
All water's connected everywhere. But in Florida, you know, it's very easy to see the effects because
yeah,
the Chaz
is spring fed and there's springs there. Some very interesting springs, but their flow is greatly reduced. And, you know, that's what's happening. Saltwater is getting further inland and you can, you know, that's heartbreaking because you see these dying trees because they can't live where there's saltwater. And God, what a great example of, and as sea level rise happens too, that's another thing that's happening is the saltwater is coming further inland and wreaking havoc on those natural systems that, you know, need fresh water to exist. Yes, we get political on this show, damn it.
A little bit, damn it. Hey, before we go, we have a new listener this week, a new subscriber.
I hope they like politics.
Well, so I got to tell you, her name is Elise Smith. And we'll give a shout out, of course, to all of our listeners at the end of the episode. But I want to definitely single out Elise because I had a interesting speaking gig this weekend. There is a Florida writer slash singer slash songwriter, Shayna Smith. She spends part of her time in St. Pete, part of it in Gainesville. And
that's a life right there. The
no
two
kidding,
of my favorite
right?
places. Yeah.
She had written a book a few years ago called Islands of Cedar. And I love the book. No clue that she lived here part of the time. If you haven't read this book, Rick, you should read it. It's a novel, but it is based on the history of Rosewood, and it's just fantastic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So at one of my Florida Spectacular events, I met a librarian for a library in North County, and he introduced himself and said, "Hey, I'm trying to recreate back roads in pictures." And I thought that was fascinating. And so we talked for a while, and a few days later, I got an email from him going, "Hey, Shanna Smith's speaking at the library in January. Would you be interested? And we'll pay you to come speak with her." I said, "Sure," because, you know, I like Shanna Smith, and also it's money and I need to sell books. So we met last Friday at a place called the Chataway, had some burgers, talked about what we were going to do. And what we decided to do was she would sing one of her Florida songs, and I would come up with a passage from one of my books to read that correlated to it. So it was almost like a game show. Like, she'd be singing something and I'd be trying to, you know, desperately paging through my book, trying to find something that correlated to her Florida song. Anyway,
so this wasn't planned. I mean, you didn't have any advance notice. You had to listen to the lyrics.
Yep.
Real time, and like, whoa, that's yep. Tough.
Yeah, it was, I had to channel my best Gary Mormino, where I just could make anything about Florida. So, but set up there, it's, you know, of course, 2.5 degrees or whatever it was last week. And this woman walks in, and she has not only a copy of Backroads and one of Florida Spectacular, she has this very thin book that I published on Amazon because it was my semester research on Boca Ciega Bay and Clam Bayou. And I was giving a talk to a bunch of students at Eckerd, and the people who were coordinating the talk with me figured out that the least expensive way to get the people in the talk this was to create a little tiny chapbook and put it on Amazon, and they could buy it for $9. Because it's like, you know, Eckerd doesn't like to make copies. They want to go paperless. Anyway, this woman had this book, and no one had ever shown me this book before, because it's not setting the world on fire. It's not like the Carl Hiaasen Dead Body and Clam Bayou story. It's just an environmental history that was a little academic. And she goes, "My husband went online and he knew I liked you, so he found this book that you had written." And she had driven up from Estero to Palm Harbor. And I was so impressed with that. I feel like she definitely deserves like a shout out on the podcast, because that's like, I believe, like 200 miles.
You got a hardcore fan there.
No, 130 miles. Yeah, no, it's by Cape Coral. So, I mean, it's not a horror, but that was, yes. So, Elise, you definitely, definitely you win. You win the podcast for the week.
You win a shout out. Woo!
Yeah. It's a big deal. We still have our other listeners, too, that we love. Davita Breyer. Natalie Zachrick, John Bone, Ryan Worthington, who we just mentioned, Michael Gargalak, Leslie Hallwig, Carol Miller, she's our second newest, and then a woman named Lisa joined, I think it was a New Year's resolution, judging by the date she joined, and then one of our longest time listeners, Angela Connolly. So thank you all for listening and supporting us with your money.
So. That's awesome. So you talked about a talk. I'm giving a talk on Saturday, and I know you people may not listen to it, but in a little town called Enterprise on the north side of Lake Monroe. And how this ties in is nearby is a county park for Volusia County Park called Green Springs singular, I think. One of my favorite springs. It's hard for me to drive by without stopping because it's just so, you know, it's got these big live oak trees that go over the spring, and it's not clear water. It's always this kind of emerald sapphire-ish color. Sometimes it's emerald, sometimes it's sapphire. Love the place. There used to be a spa there, but I was going to ask you without thinking, three favorite springs.
My three favorite springs. Damn it.
No thinking. Just name them.
Wakulla, Weeki Wachee, and Manatee.
Ooh, and, good.
Yeah, I know they're all super popular, though. I don't know. That's not even true, because then there's Three Sisters at Crystal River, and then there's Sulphur Springs, and what about all the little tiny springs that don't even have names that I see? I mean, that's like asking me to pick a favorite cheese, and that's really not fair.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, Rick, your three favorite springs. Not
well. I mentioned Green Spring, and it's just so off the beaten. It's just different than the rest. I think one of my favorite springs to swim in is Gilchrist Blue. It's one of the blue springs. It's a new state park, and they're making a lot of changes there that are improving the health of the spring. So I highly recommend a visit. It's near High Springs, and then I got to pick a third. That is tough. I'm just going to go with Silver Springs. We talked about the glass bottom boat ride. It's hard to beat that. They're doing it. The state park has evolved there. So it's just got it going on, and it's just getting better. And there, what gives me, encourages me is to see all the people there on the water taking advantage of the resource, you know, and I know people who don't like calling natural things resources, but this is the reason they're on the water, you know, in a kayak or a canoe or a stand-up paddleboard, because they want to see this spring. And anything that gets people out on the water, I think, is good.
I tend to agree with you. The more you get out on it, the more you're going to really appreciate it. I am very excited to be going out kayaking, not on a spring this weekend, but out on a bioluminescence tour with Ayalani, who we mentioned that I'd be going on his thing last week, I think, the bioluminescence. He was on the podcast a few weeks ago. And it's not a long, the point of this is not that it's not a spring, but that I don't believe this is a long paddle. It's not, you know, one of those journey overnight sleeping in chickies in the Everglades, but it's just something to get people out on the water. Yeah. And I think that if you get people out on the water, you have a much better chance of them really appreciating it.
Yeah, let's hope so. Let's hope they're not there to party and drink beer and leave beer cans everywhere, which happens at some of our springs.
Not Jenny Springs.
No.
I mean, I hate to say that because I know everybody loves their Jenny Springs, but it's not.
It's not bad love. It's bad love.
It's a bad love. That's a good way to put it. I don't know how else to put it.
You got to love the springs the right way.
You have to. Yeah. Nobody loves them the right way.
Yeah.
God. All right. Well, all that said, thank you, Rick, for sharing your springalicious knowledge.
My pleasure.
And I believe we have the guest next week. Do you mean
we
us?
Do? We're gonna talk about the Flamingo Cafe in Orlando of the 1940s.
Yes. So you're going to want to read in preparation for this is, and of course, the one
Secrets.
I have pulled. I have my wrong reader. Yes.
Secrets of the Flamingo Cafe.
I had my Apple Books app pulled up to make sure I had it right, but I think I have that on Kindle. So
yeah.
Anyway, Secrets of the Flamingo Cafe by Joy Wallace Dickinson. So if you're listening to this real time as we publish it, come back next week. If you are listening to this after January 22nd, 2025, just advance right to the next episode, because I'm sure it's going to be even better than this one.
More than likely.
Well, no pressure for Joy for next week. All right. That'll do it, folks. We'll see you next time on the Florida Spectacular.